Roger Corman is considered the godfather of the low-budget B-movie. He was responsible for such cinematic efforts as Swamp Women, Death Race 2000, Women in Cages, Attack of the Giant Leeches, Sharktopus, and the list goes on. But Corman was also one of the first to distribute foreign art films by auteurs such as Ingmar Bergman within the United States, and he launched the careers of major stars and directors and was given a special Academy Award in 2009. One of the people whose careers was intertwined with Roger Corman is Beverly Gray, and she has written a book about Roger Corman's career and her involvement in it. It's called Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers. It's just been released in an expanded third edition, and we welcome Beverly Gray to the show. Thanks so much for being with us, Beverly.
It's my pleasure.
In Roger Corman's career, at least when it comes to film, art was very often a victim to commerce.
Well, there's an interesting tension between art and commerce in Roger's work, and that's what part of what makes him so interesting to me, because filmmakers will tell you that this is a man who knew something about, if not the arts, and certainly the craft of movie making, and they learned from him. So that famous people of today, like Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, they grew up on Corman movies, so they were learning not just the commercial aspects, which are very important when you talk about Roger, but also the artistic aspects of how you introduce horror, suspense, leaven it with humor, a little TNA. There's an aesthetic there that a lot of people have emulated.
Corman is, you know, despite that list of credits, he's an educated, kind of intellectual guy. And
yes.
When you first came to work for him and get to know him, that was a little bit of part of the vetting process. Talk about how you came to get to know Roger Corman and work for him.
Thank you for bringing that up. It is really a good story. You've got to understand that I had really never heard of Roger Corman when I got the invitation to come in and interview for a job as his assistant back in the early 70s and the early days of New World Pictures. I was finishing a PhD in contemporary American fiction at UCLA, and I was writing on intellectual novelist types like Vladimir Nabokov. So I was an intellectual who also went to the movies and wrote, just for the fun of it, movie reviews for the local school paper. But one day, a faculty friend of mine came to me and said that a man named Roger Corman had phoned him and was looking for an assistant, and would I be interested? Well, I needed a job, so of course I was interested, but I went in not quite knowing who this guy was. I had some inkling that he made monster movies and biker movies. I went into his office and saw, as everyone's always surprised to see what Roger looks like. He, if you imagine a Roger Corman type as being the guy with the big cigar and the gold chains, you're wrong. Roger is very trim. He's kind of professorial looking. He's a good looking man, conservatively dressed. And he said to me, Beverly, if you come and work for me, I would like you to read Siegfried Krakauer's Theory of Film and we'll discuss it. So naturally, I went home and read Siegfried Krakauer's Theory of Film, which I must tell you is a long and heavy book. And when I went to work for Roger, I kept waiting for that day when we would have this intellectual discussion. But instead, I was immediately put to work on the scripts of Cockfighter and Death Race 2000, and the subject never came up again. But that's an interesting thing about Roger. He is educated. He is, in some ways, he's a very classy guy. He's interested in contemporary art. He's interested in film theory. He's interested in all sorts of things, at the same time that he gets a great deal of pleasure out of making movies about monsters.
Yeah, it's probably quite a bit of a jump from a studying Russian novelist to going to working on the script for Cockfighter.
It was indeed.
Because of Corman's intellectual bent and his appreciation for really artistic films. As I mentioned earlier, he was instrumental in distributing some very, very artistic films from Europe into the United States. First person to take a chance on doing that.
You know, I'm really glad you brought that up because that's an important aspect of him. It wasn't his idea initially. His sales manager at the time, Frank Moreno, was really the guy who gets the credit for coming up with the idea. These films were being made, nobody at the big studios particularly wanted to distribute Ingmar Bergman's Cries and Whispers, and Frank, who loved movies of that nature, saw possibility. And he went to Roger with the possibility of distributing Ingmar Bergman. The financial deal was a very good one, but this was not your usual movie. And I worked for Roger at that time. When I heard that we were going to distribute the latest Bergman, I said, who's going to do the ad campaign for that? Because I had visions of the kind of posters that we were doing at the time, which was things like, it's always harder at night for the night call nurses. I didn't think that would really suit an Ingmar Bergman story, and I was assured that we would not be doing that sort of thing in-house. But we did distribute Cries and Whispers, which was nominated for 4 or 5 Oscars. We distributed Fellini's Amarcord, and in virtually all of those great films, over a 10-year period, Roger made money, put these movies into places where they hadn't normally been. He had Bergman's films playing in drive-ins in the Midwest, and Bergman was thrilled that his movie was getting around in ways it never had before. So you've got to give Roger a lot of credit for being open and willing to do that. Now, of course, that helped to make those European art films a great deal more expensive over time, at which point Roger bowed out. He wanted to make money, not spend money.
Did he have ambitions to make more artistic films earlier in his career and wasn't able to do that, wasn't able to make money?
I have a great story about that. As you know, he did make a lot of money with films that had an artistic quality, like the Edgar Allan Poe films, which are very elegant in their way and then very beautifully shot. But the one film that I'd like to talk about now is a film that Roger, in some moods, will say was his proudest moment. It's called The Intruder, and it was made in the early 60s, I believe the year might have been 1962, at a time when the civil rights movement was truly heating up. And this was based on a very interesting novel in which a mysterious stranger goes to a southern town which is just on the brink of having to integrate its school. And this mysterious fellow, for reasons of his own, comes to the town and starts stirring up everybody's emotions. It was a pretty gutsy film. Roger cast, by the way, someone who nobody had heard of at the time, a guy named William Shatner. That was his first big role. But Roger at first thought this was going to be backed by some studio or another, or distributed at least by a studio. And everyone got nervous. So Roger had to put his own money into the film. It was made 100% in the border towns, not quite in the Deep South, but in southern Missouri, which has, in many ways, the mindset, or had in many ways the mindset of the Deep South at that time. It was kind of a brave act. Apparently the FBI was poking around while this was being made. Townspeople were being used as extras, were a little volatile. It was really a brave thing to do. So he made this movie, which is not a movie without flaws, but is a brave, interesting movie considering the time. And it got some very serious, respectful reviews in places like the New York Times. However, this movie did not make money, and Roger had said when he was interviewed about why he had made this film, which was not a monster movie, not a horror movie, not his usual fare at all, and he said, I want to make movies like this that really have something to say. I'm not in it to make money. So long as we don't lose money, I'll go on making gutsy pictures like this one. So they did lose money. And Roger, true to his word and true to his basic mentality, decided that enough was enough when it came to making a political statement. And his next movie was The Premature Burial. So he went back to horror. He liked to slip in message now and again. He certainly had his political and social convictions. But that was as close as he came at that time to making a 100% art film.
We're talking with Beverly Gray. She is the author of Roger Corman, Bloodsucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers. She served as Roger Corman's story editor for a decade or more, and she blogs on her site, beverlyinmovieland.com. One of the things you had mentioned earlier is that so many of these young people that came up and worked for Roger learned their trade in a way that did employ itself later on when they had an opportunity to work without budget constrictions or when they stretched out as artists. And What I think is interesting is that Corman, although he might have had certain convictions that did seep their way into movies, would always watch the bottom line. And there's a story about Martin Scorsese, who made movies for Roger Corman. Martin Scorsese wanted to have Roger produce Mean Streets, the movie that would become Mean Streets. And when Scorsese brought that idea to Corman, what happened?
That's actually a funny story, because Roger was always looking for whatever was the trend at the time. And so Scorsese came and he had this story of low-life types in, was it the Bronx, somewhere in New York City. And Roger said, well, this was the era of blaxploitation, and his brother Gene Corman had done rather well with a kind of gritty, black, down-and-dirty ghetto movie. And he said to Martin Scorsese in so many words, if you're willing to swing a little and make all your characters black, I will fund it, and you can take your crew to New York and film it where it happened. Well, Scorsese, I don't know how long he thought about that, but he realized this was not the movie he wanted to make. And he had some warnings about Roger that if you want to pursue your own artistic path, you've got to be careful not to knuckle under to the Roger Corman formula. So he said, well, thanks, but no thanks. And that's why, and I love this, Mean Streets was actually shot. It's a quintessential New York movie, but it was shot in L.A.
Yeah, and it had so much to do with Scorsese's own background as an Italian-American.
That's right.
One would almost wonder if maybe Roger Corman would have known that. And that is where I find his role in the movie industry so interesting, because he did launch the careers of so many people like Martin Scorsese and even Francis Ford Coppola, James Cameron, John Sayles, the list goes on and on and on. And they learned stuff working for Roger. But ultimately, Roger was not too keen on taking too much of a financial risk. He wanted to kind of keep the movies small, knowing that they didn't have to make a huge profit.
Right, so that a James Cameron, who came out of nowhere, was a guy who was tinkering with some gadgets that he wanted to get on to Battle Beyond the Stars with, found his way into being the art director for Battle Beyond the Stars and so on, but he didn't have much of a future with Roger because his ideas were very big and expansive, as of course they continue to be, and Roger just wasn't ready for that. But I'd like to mention Ron Howard, because that's really a classic story, and it's one that Ron told me himself. Ron Howard, of course, wasn't a nobody. He wasn't the James Cameron who had no background, who just came out of nowhere. Ron Howard, at the time he worked with Roger Corman, was very, very famous as Opie on the Andy Griffith Show as a little kid, and then as Richie on Happy Days. So it was while he was doing Happy Days, and was a huge teen idol type of guy. He was also, at the time, a student at the USC Film School. He had long wanted to move from being an actor, a very successful actor, to being a director. But nobody in Hollywood really saw him in that role. To him, he was still this cute little guy. So Roger was making a movie called Eat My Dust. It was a teen car crash movie. Things like that were very popular at that time. So he was making this movie, and the writer-director of it, Chuck Griffith, who incidentally also wrote Little Shop of Horrors and a lot of other older Corman classics, Chuck came up with the idea of Ron Howard as just being perfect for the teenage boy in the souped-up car that he was creating. They approached Ron Howard, would he star in this movie? Now, Ron Howard didn't need to make this movie. He had plenty of money. He had plenty of opportunities. However, Ron was a very smart guy and realized that when you went to work for Roger, you could perhaps leverage that into something that he badly wanted, which was chance to direct. So he went into Roger in let's make a deal mode. You know, if I star in this movie, will you back me as the director of this script that I have right here, which was a movie that ended up never being made. It was called Tis the Season, and it was kind of a holiday film. That's what he wanted to make. And Roger, being Roger, didn't just say sure. He said, no, if you star for me in this movie, and if you write another movie on the subject of my choosing, and if I like the script, then you can direct it. Well, that's exactly what happened. Eat My Dust was a great big hit, thanks in many ways to Ron Howard's acting contribution. And Roger said, I want another movie like that one, another movie about teens and cars and mayhem and a certain comic element, and that became Grand Theft Auto, which was written by Ron Howard in tandem with his father, Rance Howard, and then was part of the requirement, too, was that Ron Howard would have to star in his own movie because, of course, he was a box office draw. So he starred in and directed Grand Theft Auto and really, really learned from Roger Corman how to budget, how to shoot fast. I mean, people used to compete to see who could do the most sit-ups in directing a Roger Corman movie. And one day, Ron had something like 90 sit-ups. I mean, he just was really cranking. And it's a complicated story, and it could not have been done if Ron hadn't been very, very good at being organized, working it all out, working out all the details of where the cast and the crew and the props and the equipment would be at any given time, so that within the 3 weeks or so that were allotted to shoot this movie, everything that needed to be shot got taken care of. And look at him now.
And I guess Ron Howard still is making car race movies.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. Rush is a little bit more complicated and a little bit more expensive, but he learned from Roger how to strategize the movie and also how to cut it. That was the other lesson he told me about learning from Roger, how to keep cutting and keep shaping so that the movie is absolutely as exciting as it can be.
The thing about both Ron Howard and Jonathan Demme is as they move forward, then they have actually pulled Roger into their movies in small ways.
Yes. Jonathan Demme in particular loves to use Roger. So does Joe Dante. Ron Howard at first, Ron Howard's the kind of guy who used to make his parents audition for roles in his movies, and he takes this very seriously, but he was persuaded to use Roger in Apollo 13 as a U.S. senator who was quizzing NASA about cost containment, and that's the kind of role that people love to give Roger. They love to give him the job of a senator, a governor. He projects authority. And particularly if you can put him in a role which mocks his cheapskate image, it's a lot of fun.
Well, one final thing I want to ask you. In all the years that you worked with Roger and you worked on all these films, I think I'm going to mangle the quote, but I think that Roger said something along the lines of the cheapest special effects one can throw into a movie involve nudity. So there was a lot of TNA in some of those films. What was your reaction to that when you come from this PhD program? I would imagine you were a fairly liberated woman growing up in an era where that was an issue. What did you think about working on these movies where somebody was just throwing some bare breasts on there purely for titillation purposes?
It's a great question. One of the things that many, many people have to look to Roger to with gratitude is his respect for women in an office or a production setting. I mean, women have become, well, Gail Ann Hurd is a perfect example. Somebody who, with very little filmmaking background, could go on to be the producer of Terminator and all sorts of other films. He really respects smart women, treats them very well. In some ways, and I get into this in the book because Roger's psychology is interesting, seems more comfortable with women and appreciative of women. On the other hand, there's that TNA element, and of the hundreds of people I talked to for the book, there's a certain debate going on in terms of to what degree is this a little bit prurient on his part, and to what degree is it a hard-nosed understanding of what the public wants. But women could feel a little uncomfortable working in his office. I know somebody who decided she'd really worked for him long enough after she had to negotiate a contract for an overseas production in which she had to negotiate how much pubic hair would be shown by one of the young lovelies in the movie. So those of us working in the office didn't personally feel harassed, but we were also making movies in which we knew full well how female nudity and, you know, the flaunting of the body was being used. Also, Roger liked strong heroines, like Angie Dickinson and Big Bad Mama, so in a way he was glorifying women, but he was also glorifying women who just happened to have some reason to take off their clothes. So the ambivalence there is one of the topics that I find extremely interesting when you talk about Roger and his movies.
Beverly Gray worked with Roger Corman for many years as his story editor for his production company, and she's the author of The book Roger Corman, Bloodsucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers, now in a third and revised edition. You can also check out her writing on beverlyinmovieland.com. Beverly, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's been lots of fun.